This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. And so often we don't understand what has been done in that regard and what some of the incredible stories right in our backyard might be. If you happen to hang around Cascade Manor in Eugene, Oregon, you might run into a guy who was somewhere pretty significant on December 7th, 1941. But he grew up in Southern California, and that's where we'll start with 93-year-old Sam Fryfield, an only child. You lost your mother when you were very young. How old were you?
Five
years old. That had to create some significant challenges growing up, but I get the picture. Just getting to know you here, you seem pretty resilient. I bet you got used to it pretty quick.
I seem to feel that way that I did, because I moved around every 2 years approximately until 1936, when I moved in with my dad there at Wilmington. And then after I left him, I went to the Navy.
Yeah, you went in the Navy, obviously, before Pearl Harbor. That's how you ended up there in December of 41. But you graduated from Banning High School. What was life like in Southern California? Because today you say Southern California, and people say, okay, it's Hollywood, it's the beach, it's, you know, there's so many stereotypes. But I have an idea that it might have been a little different back in the late 1930s. What do you remember?
I was standing on the corner of Avalon and Anaheim in Wilmington, California, selling the Los Angeles Herald Express.
Hey.
At a nickel copy, I got 2 cents of it.
Do you remember what your ambitions might have been at that age, what you were dreaming of doing?
Well, yes. I really intended to be an electrician, but I didn't manage to get on after I graduated from high school. After I got in the Navy, there was a possibility. The Navy had a program where if you made third class storekeeper or yeoman, and maybe some of the others, and if you passed the test, which was a very simple one really, you could transfer to electrician third class.
All right.
But I didn't qualify until January 1st of 42.
And some other things developed. Tell me why you joined the Navy in the first place, because, you know, they certainly weren't drafting anybody yet.
I knew that more was coming.
How'd you know?
I've been reading newspapers.
Well, if you were selling them, I guess you were reading them.
And I was reading the pertinent magazines describing what was going on. And also, I did have some contacts, Navy people there in Wilmington. So, as I say, I just knew it was coming. I felt I should get in before they passed the draft.
So you could decide where you wanted to go instead of them deciding for
well,
you?
Well, no, it's that I could decide whether I wanted the Army, the Navy, or Marines.
What
so
was it
I
about the
Navy?
Navy.
I liked the uniform a lot better.
All right, as simple as that. It wasn't the meals. It wasn't you wanted to get out on the sea. You just looked better.
Well, yes, I wanted to go to sea.
Well, the ladies did love those bell bottoms, from what I understand. So you joined the Navy. Did you ever get to a point where you regretted that decision?
No particular time. I might have had times when I felt trod upon, but in general, I got my paycheck, I got my food, I got liberty. I started on the USS Crosby, DD-164. DD means destroyer.
Yeah, tin can.
An old tin can whose hull laughingly was described as two coats of rust, two coats of paint, two coats of red lead.
So you didn't feel particularly secure on that ship?
I knew it was all right. It had been commissioned in 1921, I think, and then put in reserves there in the fleet there in San Diego. They recommissioned it in 39 sometime. I went aboard September of 40, but the Navy said, no, we're going to take a bunch of you guys off the Crosby and put you on other ships and turn the ship over to the reserves. So they took me off. I ended up on the Detroit. I eventually got into the pay office and stayed in the pay office as long as I was aboard her.
I haven't researched the Crosby. Do you know what happened to that destroyer in the war?
Yes, she was changed to an APD. That's a high-speed transport.
Uh-huh.
She served honorably through the rest of the war. She was involved in a lot of activity in taking small groups in and picking small groups up. But the Crosby, I think, survived. And the moment the war was over, really scrapped her.
As they did with quite a few ships. Mm. So you go from this destroyer to the Detroit, which was significantly bigger.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Was that an adjustment?
No. You're one of a large number of men. Mm-hmm. You go to the same place to eat. You might have different battle stations, but you're pretty insignificant in theory. En masse, you're very, very effective.
You said you wanted to get in the Navy. You were looking forward to getting out to sea. And I'm sure that being assigned to Hawaii, or at least being sent there, had to be a little exciting for a kid who grew up in Southern California, pretty tropical location. What kind of fun did you have out there?
Swimming. One of my places of enjoyment was a large theater out along Waikiki that had a large and beautiful organ. I don't know. I think it was on Sundays that they would have organ concerts.
Uh-huh.
And I, as much as I could, I went out there. I also did some sightseeing, more or less. In those days, they still were growing pineapple, a lot of it. Twice I can remember I went through pineapple growing and packing places. Somebody had the bus that went all the way around the island. I think it took us about 8 hours to
probably take longer now with all the traffic.
Well, no, it doesn't. No, I've been there. It doesn't take that long, but I can remember that that's one long ride and somewhat bumpy occasionally.
They didn't have the H1 all paved yet at that point.
I don't know what they had.
Well, and what I'm curious about, because we know now, you know, with the lens of history, we know what happened on December 7th. But did you guys have any inkling that things could be boiling, that the Japanese were poised to attack? Was there any suspicion at all?
I don't know what anybody else believed.
Right.
From my own observations, I could see that the war was coming, but I will not ever brag that I knew it was coming or anything. I agreed with the assessment of the big shots that it was going to be the Philippines. So when it did happen, I wasn't totally surprised.
Well, and it was the Philippines, too, pretty much simultaneously. But you didn't know it was coming to you there on Oahu. Yeah. So that Sunday morning, where were you? How did you realize that America was under attack? Walk me through those moments, if you can.
Well, I had slept late, and I was the last man in chow line. It was topside, and it was right up near the top of the ladder to go down to the mess hall. I heard an explosion, and I ran out to the rail. I looked aft, and the debris was still coming down. A torpedo had hit the Utah. Then I heard a plane. I looked out midships, and here was a plane dropping a torpedo in my lap. I don't know for sure what happened. In the book, it went aft. It went between us and the Raleigh, and went up on the shore. Somebody else said that it went underneath, but in the official war diary, it missed, went.
So when you say right in your lap, you're at the rail of the ship, and you see a plane heading right at your ship?
Yeah.
And it drops the torpedo into the water right in front of your ship?
Probably 200 or 300 yards out when we dropped it.
Wow. So then you're just waiting for something to happen.
Oh, no. One doesn't wait. One runs to a battle station.
Yes, sir.
Post haste.
And where was your battle station?
In way aft in the chief's quarters. And we handled the ammunition for the surface guns. We had 6-inch guns. Well, since we didn't use the 6-inch guns for the air attack, well, I think there were 10 or 12, I don't remember how many men, 10 or 12 of us sat down there for over 2 hours chewing our fingernails. We could hear distantly the big booms of the battleships getting hit, and also the hundreds of rounds of a 3-inch 50, we could hear that going off a huge amount.
But you guys needed to be there in case someone decided to use the big guns.
That was our battle station.
Right.
So yeah, when they said, load it up, well, we would have sent the rounds up to the turret.
And how did that work? How did you get them there?
There's an elevator, which was to prevent fires from reaching the magazine down below, and then to make sure that any explosion wasn't going to transfer from one end to the other.
Right. So that's where you were.
That's where I was.
For 2 hours.
For over 2 hours.
What was going through your head?
Well, I almost got shot.
How'd that happen?
I worked in a pay office.
Right.
And one of my senior petty officers was Chief Grignon. I was in the chief's quarters. And all of those who had been eating jumped up and went to their battle stations. So the tables had this food on them. I had not had a breakfast. So I was reaching for a slice of toast on one table. And Grignon, who, being the petty officer in charge of the group, told me to leave it alone. Put his hand on the 45. I went without breakfast.
I guess so. It would have been a real tragic story of the guy who died on December 7th because of a piece of toast.
Yes, that's one thing.
So when you finally emerged from there.
The first thing that they had us do, there were a large number of shell casings from the 3-inch 50 especially lying about on the deck. I and several others were put to work to throw them over. Then we were low on fuel. We had come in on Friday, low on fuel. We were planning to refuel. They said, no, come in tomorrow. But then they said, later on, they said, no, wait until Monday. So we were low on fuel. So now we were ordered, go over there and get some fuel. Then we headed out, going to the coast of the island to see if the Japanese were trying to land troops anyplace.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something. When you mentioned being low on fuel, and you alluded to the torpedo earlier, and you said there are differing theories on what happened with it, but if it did indeed go under your ship, the fact that you were low on fuel may have saved you, right?
That was my usual statement until a few years ago, especially after reading this, I decided, no, it did go between us and the Raleigh.
And explain to us where you guys were positioned that morning, because I'm sure some people maybe have been to the Arizona Memorial and they've seen the diagrams, or maybe they've read some books about it, but there are a whole lot of ships in a whole lot of different places. Where was the Detroit when this happened?
We were moored at what's called Fox 13 along Ford Island, which is maybe a half mile from where Battleship Row was.
Right.
There's the Detroit. The Raleigh, another four-stack cruiser, was behind us, then the Utah and the Tangier. Now, this was normally a place where aircraft carrier would have been tied up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, aircraft carrier would draw more water than we would.
Absolutely.
So I, at one time, felt that both things, blow on fuel and being where a carrier would be, that pilot didn't know what he was doing. He saw a ship there where it was supposed to be a ship, and he dropped his torpedo, which was set to go low enough that it would get the carrier.
Right.
But it was too low to hit a light cruiser.
Especially one that was low on fuel and was sitting higher in the water.
Yeah.
So whether that happened or it went between you and the Raleigh, what you do know is the Raleigh was hit and the Utah was sunk.
Yeah.
So your ship was pretty fortunate to not be hit.
Yes, we were. Anyway, we left there, we fueled, then we headed out and went out looking, as I say, for the Japanese fleet or any activities. Didn't find it. Came back in. We were there for a couple of days, and then we took off convoy duty, headed for San Francisco.
Well, and there was probably a scramble to get you out of the harbor so you wouldn't be trapped in there.
That was one of the things. It's reported that we went out there in a hurry so that any subs firing would not get us.
Right.
Well, we didn't get hit, so I don't know if they had any.
And even though you're out there looking for possible Japanese forces, you didn't find any. And that's probably a good thing, too?
Yes. Because there was a heavy cruiser and a light cruiser and some destroyers.
So you wouldn't have been a very imposing collection of American forces if you ran into some serious Japanese ships. Oh, and while you were below deck, prepared to load that ammunition, you mentioned hearing the different things happening. And you heard the explosion that took down the Arizona?
Probably the Arizona. That one was a mighty one.
Mm-hmm. 2,400 Americans lost their lives that day, nearly half that number on the USS Arizona. The USS Detroit is the ship Sam Fryfield was on, and we have much more of his story to come when Hometown Heroes continues. I'm also very pleased to welcome a new affiliate station to the Hometown Heroes team from Sam's home state of Oregon. 1430 KYKN in Salem bills itself as the most listened to station between Portland and Sacramento, and we're very thrilled with the opportunity to bring this show to the audience there in Oregon and, of course, all the other stations airing Hometown Heroes. Big thanks to Program Director Gator Gaynor for jumping on board. And before we jump back into Sam's story, maybe you'd enjoy the one-minute video of him pointing out exactly where he was on December 7th, 1941. I have that up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. But always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us.
The words of Franklin Delano Roosevelt back in December of 1941, and what he described is something our guest today, 93-year-old Sam Fryfield of Eugene, Oregon, experienced firsthand aboard the USS Detroit. We heard how the attack unfolded from his point of view on that Sunday morning and what his duties were from that point.
Can you help us understand what that did to your ship, to those men, to what your mindset now became in the wake of this surprise attack? Did it anger you? Did it motivate you? Did you notice something different about your ship afterwards?
I really had so little social contact that I can't give you anything more than my own feelings on that. A feeling that I said it was coming, and it did. I knew that much. I just lived my life aboard whatever. I did whatever I was supposed to do, did it to the best of my ability. I did have to ask for the transfer in order to get promoted, so that's why I went to the Proteus ultimately. But as for the spirit of the men of the ship, I have no recollection of formulating.
Sure. No, and I understand that. And I'm sure you know why I'm asking, because, you know, it did have such an impact on the nation. And that rallying cry of Remember Pearl Harbor, and even the song, you know, that became popular, was something that galvanized not just the Navy, but the entire nation. So I was just curious how that worked for you, if it motivated you to fight this war.
I must have been a fatalist, because I just said, well, I joined the Navy to do whatever they told me to do. And if it said to fire a gun, I would. If they told me to pay off a couple of sailors, I'd do that.
It didn't stir big emotions for you.
Psychologically and philosophical thoughts were few and far between. I hope that I wouldn't get into a battle. May I point out,
sure,
side issue.
Yeah.
Other than that torpedo, which was dropped and intended for our ship, I never got shot at again in the whole war.
How about that? That's not easy to do. So you had a big one coming at you at the very beginning.
The very first day, that one, and no more after that.
That's remarkable. And I want to hear about what you did the rest of the war, but with the significance of Pearl Harbor, I'm sure that, you know, in all the reunions over the years, certainly you've thought about it. I'm sure that every December 7th, it's something that comes to mind for you.
I'm very sympathetic for what would be a huge group, people I never knew, but who were part of my life, too. In other words, the families of 1,100 men killed in one ship. I did have some thoughts about that. That was bitter thoughts. Thoughts of, oh boy, I wish I had somehow known I could warn, but that was dreaming.
Yeah, and that was the Arizona. There's more than twice that number total when you think about the Utah and the Oklahoma and everyone else that was killed that day. Did you ever think that could have been me?
Oh, yes.
Torpedo did that for you, I guess, huh?
Yeah, that gave me a notice that it was possible.
Have you been back there?
Oh, yes, several times.
What do you experience? What kind of emotions come to mind when you go there?
The first time, an emotion of, which included the 2,400, then seeing that Arizona Memorial said these guys deserved life, but they paid the price.
Mm-hmm.
So that the rest of us could have life.
Amen.
That's about it. Now, the next time my wife and I went on a cruise, we went to the islands. So naturally, when we went to Oahu, well, I said, well, we're going to go out to the memorial. All right. We went out there, and I was the only visiting Pearl Harbor survivor. And we got in line to get into the movie. Have you been out there, by the way?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We got in line to get into the movie. All of a sudden, I had my hat on.
Your Pearl Harbor survivor's hat, sure.
All of a sudden, here's this other survivor comes running over. Come with me. Come on. Took me in, opened the door. Hold it a minute. I got some important people here. He was saying to the other people.
Right.
Took us in, set us down, seats way up front. We got ready to go. I mean, got it all finished. He says, hold it. I got important people here. Took us out, and these young kids are saluting me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a chief. A chief, you don't salute.
Right.
But that's all right, son. But that was nice being honored that much.
Sure.
There I did feel sort of proud that I was one of those who put in four years to see that the people back there on the West Coast didn't have to learn to speak Japanese.
And to make sure that those 2,400 didn't die in vain.
Well, I guess they were part of my thoughts, yeah. They didn't die in vain.
And while we're on that topic, again, since we're talking Pearl Harbor, let's stay there for a little while. If you're down to 1,500 now, in a few years from now, it's going to be down to zero. What do you want the rest of us to remember? When you say remember Pearl Harbor, what is it that we need to learn from what happened all those years ago?
Just learn that it is possible for a group of people to lay down their lives, to offer at least their life, in hopes of preserving the country that they've grown up in. Mm-hmm. And the life that they have had, and pass it on to their children, their grandchildren, and that's about it.
And your children and grandchildren wouldn't be here if that torpedo had come right literally
well,
in your lap.
Yeah, well, it could have just disabled me.
That's the spirit. So you get off of the Detroit, and you go on to a ship called the Proteus.
I put the Proteus in commission. I had left the Detroit in October of 43, stayed a while at Bremerton, finally was transferred down to San Francisco to work on the project of taking up all of the pay records that were there at Treasure Island. After we got out to the ocean, we went to Pearl for a little while and then went out to Midway, which, marvelous. I got to where I was playing handball at least three times a week, and I was in great shape. I even quit smoking.
Uh-huh.
We used to go swimming a great deal and surfing on, we'd take a mattress cover, get it wet and over the head and, you know, get air in it.
Right.
Secure it, and then you could ride the waves.
Like parasailing, huh?
Well, like surfboarding, practically. It was really great out there.
Backtracking on you a little bit. So you were on the Detroit from before Pearl Harbor all the way till October of 43.
Yeah.
What did that light cruiser do during that time, from December of 41 to October of 43?
We convoyed back and forth to San Francisco. We convoyed out to Samoa a couple of times. Then we went up to the Aleutians.
Wow. And that whole time there were never any engagements with the enemy.
No engagements. Mm-hmm. No. Engagements with the weather.
I was going to say, I bet you sailed on some rough seas.
And the Aleutians weather damaged their ship somewhat.
The wind or what?
Well, the big waves that the wind made.
Uh-huh.
And we had to go back to Bremerton. We got repaired. We headed for the Aleutians. And the couple of days before we got there, a Japanese group were trying to reinforce the forces that they already had on Attu and Kiska.
Uh-huh.
They were met by a heavy cruiser and some destroyers that were outgunned. It was Salt Lake City, I believe. It was the target of the Japs. It was dead in the water. The admiral ordered the destroyers to make a run at the Japanese fleet, putting down a smoke screen to cover the Salt Lake City. The Japanese admiral was low on fuel, and he was afraid that Dutch Harbor was going to send out planes to bomb him. So he turned around and went home, mm-hmm. took his transports with him.
Yeah, this is the Battle of the Komondorski Islands, late March 1943. I actually interviewed a vet who was on one of those destroyers there, the USS Monahan. There were 7 Americans killed and 20 more wounded, but it would have been much worse if the Japanese admiral, Hosagaya, had realized how much of an advantage he had over the Americans. He could have wiped out the U.S. forces there and been able to resupply the Japanese forces in the Aleutians. Instead, he turned back, and it turned into really a strategic victory for the Americans. And had you not been sent back for repairs after that weather damage, your ship, the Detroit, would have been there too. So you weren't in that battle, but you almost were.
We almost were.
You were fortunate not to be.
Right.
Yeah. And you mentioned that weather that damaged the ship. If those waves were enough to damage the ship, that must have thrown you around a little bit.
Oh, yes.
What did that feel like? Can you help us understand
well,
that?
Well, I'll tell you how it felt. In this pay office that I spoke of, we were against the port hull. On the inboard side, there was a built-in desk. Over here beside the pay officer's station was the safe. It was up a little bit in pretty good moorings. We had a striker, Red Anderson, who was sitting at his chair using the desk over here. A chief came to the door. The chief said, Hey, Red, I wanted blah, blah, blah. Red said, hey, it's lunchtime, Chief. Come back after you eat. The chief gritted his teeth. Instead of shooting Red, he says, come here. Red got up, started to walk over there. The ship went over, and the safe came out and crushed the chair where he had been sitting.
Mm-hmm. So good thing that chief insisted on his pay, huh? Or Red wouldn't be here.
That's right.
Wow.
So that's the kind of weather that we had. At least two times we had sandwiches, period. Mm-hmm. Because any plates on the tables, even though we had a raised edge, it wasn't enough of a raise.
They'd slide right off.
You'd try to take a bite. You take the next bite from the other guy's plate.
Well, that could be kind of interesting. You described earlier that fatalist mentality, but when you're on a ship that's listing that far from one side to the other, do you get a little scared in that situation?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't get scared. You've been riding that ship for 2 or 3 years. You don't think it's going to fail you.
Mm-hmm. Am I correct in guessing that with the nature of your duties in the pay office that you might have been a fairly popular guy?
Yes.
People wanted to treat you all right?
Yes, in general, that's true.
Did you ever have to say no to some people who wanted you to give them special treatment?
I don't really remember how often I said no. If it was possible, I would help them, but nothing really illegal.
Right. Nothing really illegal. Just maybe against policy.
Well, yeah. Some guy who was planning on going on leave the next time we hit San Francisco, I might calculate his pay as being about $10 more than what it should have been. It didn't hurt anything, really. Like you say, it was against policy. But if he needed money for making the trip back to Kansas, I'd say okay.
Sure, and feel good about it.
Yeah.
Did you ever get yourself in any trouble in the Navy?
I obviously must have, because the very last one that I had was a WAVE lieutenant who gave me a 2.5, where everybody else had given me a 4.0, and you cannot appeal a 2.5 because that's passing.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't like me.
You can't please everybody all the time, but I trust that you at home are enjoying Sam Fryfield's wit today. Sam also served on a ship called the Proteus, and we're going to discuss those duties when we come back. We'll also find out which famous movie star was on that ship. He just wasn't a big star just yet. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
History in every century records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will all liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Heard that one before? Maybe you haven't. The Sammy Kay Orchestra with Remember Pearl Harbor. And maybe you're thinking they don't make them like they used to. The words of that song certainly reflected the sentiments of the truly United States almost 75 years ago. On to victory, but at no small price. Our guest today, Sam Fryfield, has a unique perspective on that, having been on the USS Detroit, very close to the USS Utah, on December 7th, 1941. But after leaving that light cruiser, he was part of the commissioning crew for the USS Proteus, a submarine tender. Can you explain to our listeners what that means and what you had to do?
We took care of pay, filling out the allotments that men wanted, transferring pay records, writing pay checks, because they had no place to spend their money. A lot of guys would take a check and then mail it home. We kept busy. But we also had these submarines would come back from patrol.
Right.
We would have to pay them, do the same thing, write checks for all of them if they wanted to mail their money home. And in two cases, we had to close all the pay accounts for subs, for a sub.
Because it didn't come back.
Didn't come back.
Submarines are so different today compared to the way they were in World War II, the diesel subs that had to surface every night and recharge their batteries and all that. And if a sub went down, it was all hands went down with them.
There were no survivors. We didn't lose very many.
At least not during your time on that submarine tender. But in the war, throughout the whole thing, there was a higher casualty percentage in the submarine service than any other area of our armed forces. One out of every five men was lost. And 52 U.S. submarines from World War II are on what they refer to as eternal patrol. But you're saying, as far as the subs that you dealt with in Submarine Squadron 20 operating out of Midway, you didn't have to deal with those losses quite as often.
See, we didn't have all of them.
So two of the ones that you were particularly taking care of
did
not come back, and you had the morbid duty of closing all those accounts.
Yes, yes.
How did that feel? How did that strike you?
Sick in my stomach.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there's an element of thank God it wasn't me.
Right. But it gave you, I imagine, an appreciation for the duty those submarine sailors had.
Well, poor unlucky guys, that's about the extent of it. I couldn't feel all that sorry somehow. Everybody was equal. Everybody was in it.
Yeah.
Everybody was standing up there, go ahead, shoot me if you can.
Yeah. Well, and on that note, it's important to note that they had all volunteered. The entire submarine force volunteered specifically for that dangerous duty.
Yeah.
And if you go to Pearl Harbor today, you'll find a World War II submarine. The Bowfin is still out there at Pearl Harbor. And another thing that's out there, not too far from the Arizona Memorial, is the Mighty Mo, the USS Missouri.
Yes.
And you were pretty close to the mighty Mo when the surrender was signed, were you not?
No, because I left the Proteus.
Ah, the Proteus was there, but you weren't.
I left the Proteus and ended up in the Philippines, February of 45.
Uh-huh.
I was at Tacloban and Giguan until the end of the war.
What were you doing there?
I was a chief, or I made chief in the office of the staff supply officer. I don't really know what his duties were because they gave me secret clearance. The reason they gave me secret clearance was to keep me from telling anybody about the paperwork that I had to handle concerning the shipments of hard liquor for the officers.
That's secret Navy business, huh?
Yeah. Although the captain was a gentleman. He was a Mustang, by the way, from War One.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He was in War One as an enlisted man. I loved that guy. He was really great. One time, Fryfield, take the Jeep and go out and get that package from the airstrip. It was for me. So I went out to get the package, brought it back, put it in his office. After a while, Fryfield, the package was two parts. One part was good scotch or some kind. One part was Australian beer. He said, I don't care for that beer. I tell you what, leave just one bottle, and you take the rest and split it with the men. I had two others out uh-huh. there, so there were three of them. So they each got a bottle, and I got 10. I mean, I got 9. Because the captain kept one.
Kept one.
And they each got one, so I ended up with 9.
You had a little fun there. Were you still there in the Philippines when the war ended?
Yeah. Yep.
What was that like, the news that the Japanese had surrendered?
It ended on a bitterly awful note. Awful. Yeah. We were watching a movie. This actually wasn't the end. It was the notice of the first
bomb
drop.
Uh-huh.
But the guy's, I can't even remember his name, but he was a yeoman. He worked for somebody else there in the staff. He and I were really good buddies. We had been sitting there watching the movie, and we headed back for the barracks. We had barracks to live in then. He said, oh, boy, I finally get to drink it. And I said, oh, I got one, too. A pint.
Mm-hmm.
Been carrying. He lived on the ground floor, and I lived up on the second floor of the barracks. So I went around the back and went up the stairs, and he had gone in down below. Got his bottle. I went up. I got my bottle. He went out. He got up to the top of the stairs and tripped. Crash. His bottle.
Mm-hmm. Tragedy.
Tragedy. Oh.
He'd been saving that one for a while.
He'd been saving that. At the time, he said how many years he'd been carrying it. I know that I'd been carrying it. Mine since I got it in Honolulu. Before I went out to the Philippines. So I only had mine 8 or 9 months.
But you were going to drink it to celebrate?
Yeah, so I shared with mine with him.
That's very big of you.
As he cried. That's the kind of celebration there was. Mm-hmm.
And what was it for you? Because we know now when the war started and when the war ended, but at the time there's no sign on the door that says, okay, it's going to end on August 15th of 45. What did it mean to you that the war was over and that your side had won?
Oh, it was great. I was gonna go home and get some shore duty, continue my career, which cut short at 9 years, 11 months, and 8 days. That's what I'm trying.
9 years, 11 months, 8 days. You stayed until 1949.
Right. But I did go on. Later on in 55, I joined the Air Force Reserve as a master sergeant, 15 years of it.
You mentioned watching that movie, and it triggered a memory. You had no idea at the time, but there was a guy on the Proteus with you all this time who went on to be a big-time movie star. Tell me when you figured that out.
I didn't know until somebody else who had been in the Detroit happened to know that.
And tell us who it was.
Tony Curtis.
Tony Curtis.
Only his name wasn't Tony Curtis. Schwartz.
Bernard Schwartz, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And he wasn't Tony Curtis yet, so no one knew any different.
That's right.
But that whole time you were on the Proteus, he was there too. I want to say thank you for serving our country And thank you for telling me about it. Thank you for helping us understand what happened then and why it matters today. When you think about it, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
No, not really. Just knowing that I was part, without actually being a true military gun-toting GI, that I at least did my bit to win the war.
Yes, you did.
Just by being there, because if I wasn't there, somebody over here would likely be speaking Japanese.
That's the reality. And in fact, where you are now, here in Oregon, there were some sightings of Japanese off the coast of Oregon.
Well, that's...
There was great
that was
concern.
It was a minor thing,
but it happened.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about this. You've got three granddaughters who I'm sure you absolutely adore. What do you think it's important for them to know and remember and teach their children someday about World War II and you and all those other Americans?
Just the fact that I did not run. I went down and I joined before it was necessary.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have to be drafted.
And you said a minute ago that, you know, because you did what you did, someone else didn't have to do that, and we're not speaking Japanese today. And the other thing that impresses me, that I think is quite admirable, that I'm sure a lot of people appreciate, is that you continue to wear that white hat of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association. Not to draw any attention to yourself, but to honor all those guys who didn't get to have the life that you've had.
Well, I get people to stop me and thank me. I had a lady just very recently caught my cap, and she came over. She was the widow of the lieutenant who became the highest-ranking surviving officer of the Arizona.
Wow, small world. And I'm sure there are more moments like that to come. We wish you many more Pearl Harbor days, and we're so thankful that you helped keep the memory of that day alive and help keep America alert. Again, you can find some photos related to Sam Fryfield's story on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. There's also that video of Sam pointing out exactly where he was in the harbor on December 7th, 1941. Next time on Hometown Heroes, we're going to meet a Las Vegas Marine who was wounded twice during World War II, but was recently reunited with a very special piece of his military experience that he had been missing for more than a half century. I'll look forward to sharing that story with you. Remember, you can find all our past episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. That's it for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.